This episode is brought to you by FX's The Veil, starring Elizabeth Moss. FX's The Veil is an international spy thriller that follows two women as they play a deadly game of truth and lies on the road from Istanbul to Paris and London. One woman has a secret, and the other has a mission to reveal it before thousands of lives are lost. FX's The Veil, now streaming, only on Hulu.
This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Forget the frustration of picking commerce platforms when you switch your business to Shopify, the global commerce platform that supercharges your selling wherever you sell. With Shopify, you'll harness the same intuitive features, trusted apps, and powerful analytics used by the world's leading brands. Sign up today for your $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/tech, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/tech.
Look, Bumble knows you're exhausted by dating. All the, must not take yourself too seriously, and 6-1 since that matters, and what do I even say other than, hey? Well, that's why they're introducing an all-new Bumble, with exciting features to make compatibility easier, starting the chat better, and dating safer. They've changed, so you don't have to. Download the new Bumble now.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Welcome to the Library Science Channel of New Books Network. My name is Jen Hoyer, and today I'm speaking with Nick Popper, author of The Specter of the Archive, Political Practice and the Information State in Early Modern Britain, published by the University of Chicago Press in January 2024. We're used to thinking of ourselves as living in a time when more information is more available than ever before. In The Specter of the Archive, Popper shows us that earlier eras had to grapple with the same problem, revealing that early modern Britain was a society newly drowning in paper. As original paperwork and copies alike flooded the government, information management became the core of politics. And in this early media-saturated society, we find the origins of many issues we face today. Nick Popper is Associate Professor of History at William & Mary in Williamsburg, Virginia. Nick, welcome to New Books Network, or welcome back, I should say.
Thanks for having me, Jen. Good to be here.
And before we start talking about your book, I would really love if you could share a little bit with listeners about your background, maybe where you grew up and went to school and what brought you to the work you're doing as a historian.
Sure. Well, I, like a lot of other academics, grew up in New Jersey, beneficiary of the very strong public school system there in the 1980s. Yes, I sort of always was from a family that was interested in ideas, had a lot of conversations about those kinds of things. I think that just got me in the, you know, I grew up in an environment that was very conducive to scholarship and academic study. For college, I went to Haverford, which is a small liberal arts college outside of Philadelphia. I think it had the best of a lot of small liberal arts traditions then. It was very small classes, a lot of engagement, accessibility of professors. It was a really great experience. I learned a lot. One of the things I learned there was that I really did love history. And the thing that drew me to history at that time was cultural history, which wasn't new then, but was kind of ascendant. And for me, it was a kind of a tool or an instrument to make sense of worlds that were not my own, that were distant in various different ways, whether geographically or for me chronologically, was the most interesting thing. And also to sort of explore the logics of individual cultures. I did not start out an early modernist, but kind of I discovered cultural history through early modern history. I had a really great mentor at Haverford, Lisa Jane Graham, who was a French Enlightenment scholar. And I just kind of fell in love with doing this kind of work and the kinds of, sort of mental experiments that it encouraged. So I worked for a couple of years, and when I went to grad school, I was fortunate enough to get into Princeton and work with the amazing Tony Grafton, who was just a superb mentor. I did history of science, which added a whole new set of kind of skills to what I did. In particular, this was in the 2000s when history of science was really sort of engaging in uptake from history of the book and media history, generally speaking, and also kind of reshaping itself with the tools of sociology or the sociology of knowledge into something like the history of knowledge. So my first book was on, how one knew the past or understood or thought about the past in early modern Britain in particular, but Europe more generally, through the study of the history of the world by Walter Raleigh. And that So at the end of that project, that I started seeing all these kinds of archival scraps floating around, and that was what brought me to this one.
Super. Well, thank you. So then, looking at this book, The Specter of the Archive, you're exploring early modern Britain as an information society. That's something that really grabbed me because I love about talking about information society at any point in time. But you describe this period as drowning in paper, and you really ground your analysis of all of that on the practices of inscription that were really surging at this moment and the impact they had on information circulation. So, could you describe for listeners what you're talking about when you refer to inscription and what kind of scale it's operating on at that period?
Sure. So inscription was a kind of, I mean, this was something I came to. I mean, I think one of the things I think I would say about this book is that I came to it from a or it developed over a long period of time. The sort of first idea for it was in 2008, and at that time it was about kind of like how to protect information from governments, and then it turned into like the next presidential regime. The balance benefits and disadvantages of technocracy, and sort of has evolved over time. What that has meant is, in order to make sense of all this material, I've kind of layered in lots of concepts and ideas about it. Inscription came late, and one of the issues, very late to it, even though it was sort of drawn from a source that I read way back when, the issue that I found was that, there's this kind of divide in, or there has been this divide based on the kind of the ways that media revolutions in early modern Europe have been talked about. There's a sort of assumption that the main revolution was a print revolution. And this comes from Elizabeth Eisenstein's classic work. And it stems actually further back to kind of anthropological differentiations between sort of oral societies, manuscript societies, and print societies, which emanates from a sort of an ethical place that I think we no longer support. There's a certain kind of scale of civilization or stage of civilizations thinking there. To me, that wasn't the issue. The issue was just that everyone was circulating information. And it was the kind of thing that I could only really see, I think, in the 2000, the teens, as this became something that became very much obvious and kind of part of the general discourse. Also, scholarly works like Anne Blair's Too Much to Know pointed this out, or sort of opened up my eyes to that. But what I didn't have from that was a sort of terminology to think about all the different ways that people might record and circulate bits of information, whether print or manuscript or images or all the varieties within it. So for manuscripts, you could have these policy treatises that are very formal, or you could have notes, or you could have lists. I needed something that would encapsulate all of those kinds of things. And at the same time, what I was trying to do was chart how they moved through space. And inscription in part comes from just a sort of common sense knowledge that inscription means to mark. I mean, like everyone, it's a technical term of a certain kind of sort, but the way that we use it is in ways just right. When you make a mark on a surface of some kind, it wasn't that complicated. On the other hand, Bruno Latour used and Steve Wolgar used it as one of their kind of central concepts back in Science in Action, or sort of early his sociology of scientific knowledge stuff. About how inscriptions are conversions of sort of real life experiences, or in their case, experiments, into data. And that was kind of, that also helped me capture the kind of distinction between what's happening, what's written down, and then what circulates. The inscription was a way to capture all of that. And so what it did for me was, in essence, like wipe out some kinds of distinctions that I thought were false. While allowing me to create like a conceptual container for that I thought was more significant and real, and actually captured what was burgeoning sort of across in its different forms across Britain and really Europe at the time. In terms of the scale, I mean, this was also what took me to paper, because in the end, you couldn't talk about the number of books or the amount of manuscripts. For one thing, it's not quite clear what the scale of loss has been. There's the customs record. I mean, like, there's just no way to really do anything particularly precise at that level. With paper, you can talk about customs records coming in. You can do these kinds of estimates. You can there's all kinds of sort of, I use some somewhat impressionistic ways in the book to measure how much there is, and how the degree to which its use was expanding. So from my perspective, relative to right now, it actually looks fairly paper, thin, or like there's not a huge amount. But one way you could see it is that over the course of the 16th century, I think that the amount of paper being introduced to Britain is at a minimum expands by 20 times. So Britain's population, and another way to put it is Britain's population in 1500 is something like 4 million, and I think, and there's probably about 1 million pieces of paper coming in a year, something like that. A century later, it's that's not very much per person. A century later, there's at least 10 sheets of paper, and these are actually quite large sheets, coming in per person. There's 5 million people and something like 40 million sheets coming in. And then, again, and it continues to grow sort of geometrically rather than linearly, so that by the end of the 17th century, the end of the 17th century, which is the first time that Britain starts actually producing paper at any scale on a domestically, it is probably doubled or tripled again, at least, in terms of the amount of materials coming in. So, and that's of course including all kind, all kinds of people who like illiterate people or people who weren't reading very much. So it's, I mean, from our perspective, who have such a live in such an information and paper, it still live in a paper dense world, even as it's scaled back. It's not relatively all that dense, but I think in comparison to the world that would have been inhabited before, it's massively different. And paper also comes to occupy this kind of important role as mediator of all kinds of political and social knowledge as well, through this.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, that point about like not just looking at the increase in print production, but this rapid expansion of paper gives a really different perspective. And so you start chapter one at the end of the 16th century, and we start tracing the state of archives in Britain at that point in time. So what did archives look like in Britain during this period, and what practices were in place to provide access to collections of records? And then I guess how did that foster a culture of inscription?
So the mid to late 16th century, I mean, by the end of the 16th century, you start having some organizational organization starts to come into many of these archives. But for the most part, before that, they're just kind of places where people dumped papers or rolls or parchment or whatever they were using in order to write stuff. I guess I should have said that during the inscription bit. I mean, parchment is still out there. There's still all these. There's still other means of inscription, but paper is the one that really transforms it by the extent of its introduction over the course of the 16th and 17th century. But you can't take the Tower of London, for example, which is a major. The Tower of London, call it a record office, although that's not officially the term back then. It has all of these rolls, these big, heavy, weighty, dusty parchment rolls dating back centuries that have been deposited there. They're all pretty much things that are like the Chancery has decided are now useless because they're 200 years old. That's mostly what's there. As far as I can tell, they're just kind of lying there on shelves. There's not periodically over the previous couple hundred years, somebody might go in and sort of neaten it up or tidy it up or make sure that all of the little tags on them aligned with so that one could find them if they wanted to, but there was not a great deal of demand for usage of them at all. And people who go in there tended to say, I can't find anything. I don't know what's there. They don't even try. One of the real sort of indicators is that the great 16th century historians of medieval British history don't even bother going to the Tower of London. They go off to they just don't do that. In fact, they don't really go to archives at all. They read chronicles, they go interview people, but they don't seem to think that any of the record the sources of records office are useful sort of sources of knowledge. So that it's a bit of a mess. What happens is that for I mean, and my perspective is that there's this kind of increase. Well, when there's a generation of humanistically trained sort of administrators and statesmen who come out of Cambridge in the after the Reformation, who are value literacy as part of the kind of Protestant project, but also I think just have a kind of greater comfort with paper. And part of it's that this is the moment when it's starting to come in more. They're moving. They're working on different offices in the regime. The Exchequer, in particular, is one of, which I don't mention in the book, is one of these places that works with paper relatively early, and so they have offices there. And they just start to see it as being a useful way to conduct business, to communicate with each other at a distance, to record certain thoughts, to circulate ideas, and they really press on each other to do it also, and their clients. And so what happens is their clients, or their ambitious clients, take this up and start moving forward with it really aggressively. So, for example, William Cecil, Lord Burghley, who's one of these guys, installs a bunch of clients in positions where they have access to various records, or they're overseeing sort of various repositories. And some of them treat these positions, which are just clerkships, and which are usually attached to other positions, which often take more of their time. Some of these guys, and they are all guys, treat the archival oversight as something that they just kind of have to do, or ideally don't even have to do. Some of them, on the other hand, think that the way to impress Burley and to get his attention and to get elevated to better roles is to take advantage of the resources, what they see as resources, right? Some people start seeing these old records as resources and using them to do things like create policies, or to create policy papers or suggestions to provide what they think of as being legal precedents. And they're often doing this on their own, and sort of, in response to the issues of the day, say, royal matches, or debts that are owed to other kingdoms, or things like that, or that are preferably the other kingdoms owe to England. They go through their papers and they start showing for their bosses really how the papers can be resources. One of those ways is to generate those kinds of policy papers, as I just suggested. Another is just to put them in order and show that, in fact, these things can be, if they are accessible, they can be used for all different kinds of projects. In particular, for example, if you're negotiating with a foreign power, to it's better to have the treaties that you're going to be that form the conditions for the discussions that you're having be readily accessible. So there's this kind of culture that arises of organizing these papers that's not really about a theory of information or anything like that. It's mostly that the people who are doing this see this as an avenue to advancement in a time where there are a lot of people competing for the attention and favor of the Elizabethan elite. So it goes to be this competitive environment where people think that doing this is one avenue to success.
Yeah, absolutely. And then you write a lot in this book about how political practice becomes tied not only to the possession of this textual material, but is also threatened by it. And we talk a lot about information overload today, but it seems, very equally present then. So what did that look like, and who was dealing with it? And then also, what kinds of practices and policies were initiated to mediate this whole glut of information?
The way that I see it, there's a kind of structure of political practice that emerges almost haphazardly out of this, in which there's oh, another way, like there's a kind of network effect. Like if everyone is working with paper, you have to work with paper too. If authority is conveyed by possession of authoritative papers, then you have to collect all the authoritative papers. And paper really is instrumental here, because what it allows everyone to do is to go into each other's archives and copy or make summaries of each other's papers. So it all kind of grows together. And it grows again. They're not in a concerted fashion, and there's no kind of compartmentalization, like along the lines of like these are the materials that belong in the Tower Record Office, so we won't have them elsewhere. I mean, everyone is making copies of other people's stuff, and this is where, again, as I say, where paper becomes really important. And yeah, it kind of overwhelms people. I mean, one of the things about the structure of practice is it's a structure of practice, but it's not like an invariably successful one. Right, a lot of times people are just copying things for the sake of having them, because they don't know what utility it might have in the future, or even or in the present, obviously. But they just think it would be good to have, for example, the abstracts of parliament rolls from time immemorial, or copies of letters that were written by that were written by Lord Chancellors in the past. I don't think they really know what good's going to come from it. It may be that they're actually often getting it, you were copying these things for ideas for sort of rhetorical purposes, right, or oratory. There's any number of reasons they could do it, but the result of it is that there's both a kind of there's a, the assumption that if you collect all of this noise, you will be able to find a signal within it at some point, if you need it. And the thing about that is, yes, they can do that, and that is part of how things work, but there's just a lot of noise also. And so what you have is this account of the individuals who have these enormous archives of paper that are just actually completely disarrayed. The difference between that and, say, the archives of the 16th century is that these guys often sort of put them together in these archive compiled these archives in their lifetime and continue to want to use them rather than seeing them as kind of like landfills for paper. And so what they do is, in order to try to moderate or sort of ameliorate this particular problem, is increasingly rely on the kinds of tools, again, that Anne Blair has most famously talked about, paratextual, or what I call para-archival tools. So catalogs, inventories, lists, these kinds of things that are supposed to help, even occasionally like a map of a drawing of the archive, that will help them negotiate or navigate them when they're looking for specific materials. But one of the ironies here, and this is the whole dynamic of the period, is that that's just more paper. And they invariably lose these things, or when they take something off the shelf, they don't put it back in the right place. So inscriptions are the sort of the way I describe it is that, inscriptions are the way to solve the problems of excessive inscription. But what you've just done is create more inscriptions. And it's just like copying and then co and copying and copying. One of the things it does is just proliferate paper and information all over the place in such a fashion that it's really difficult to navigate it. And that's kind of the condition that I think most people live in. There are a set of there are tools that people use in order to try and provide order to them, and usually most of them are kind of based on the notion like the product the process of generating sort of collections. So if you are receiving letters from a diplomatic mission, you will put them all together or something like that. But then when you have to integrate it with the entire archive, there's a whole different kind of question as to how to do it. It's actually that example is not the difficult one because if you have a whole bunch of collections of letters drawn from diplomatic trips to France, you'd put those together and maybe in chronological order or something like that. If you have some sort of complaints from the City of London about, sewers or something like that, does that go in City of London? Does it go in sewers? Does it go in courts? People have to try and navigate that issue, and they often, they do so in a way that, well, with the way that I see it, they very occasionally and often when things have just gotten so out of hand or when they have some free time, people will impose systems of classification on their archives, and then they get a whole bunch more set of like more paper, and they have no idea how to integrate them, and they just kind of go in a different room.
Yeah,
That's
absolutely.
so that that's I think the main thing. I mean, there are all of these ideas about how to organize information that are around there, but the archivists, frankly, the archivists in England don't necessarily aren't like reading closely in the kind of German, systematic thinking about how to order information. They're really trying to just deal with what they have at their hands, which is too much.
Yeah, I mean all the problems that you described feel so familiar, right?
Yes.
But I laughed out loud. There was one example that you wrote about, I forget who was like binding documents together in order to organize them, but then had to write up an index of everything in the bound volume, and he bound that into a different volume. And so it's really not dissimilar to being like, how am I going to organize my Google Drive? I will make a list of things in my Google Drive and I will store it in my Dropbox. Like all of these problems really feel the same.
Yeah, that's that was just that's Sir Julius Caesar, which I have to mention because he has one of the great names of all time, Sir Julius Caesar. And yes, he does that, and he's in the elite of power for 40 years. He has tons of stuff. He has a minimum of 70,000 sheets of paper in his office, and stuff is crossing his desk and passing through every day. He's like just drowning in paper, and he's a really important guy, and yet he has like he's just really struggling. Yes, also his handwriting is the worst of anybody ever.
Yeah, well, thank you for reading that on our behalf, I guess. And another aspect of this is the bureaucratization of things. And you make an argument in chapter three that bureaucratization wasn't a product of the time, but was actually an intentional project of specific individuals who used textual resources to carve out spheres of authority for themselves. And there are a couple of examples that you give in the book. So I would love if you could talk a little bit about how individuals were really wielding information policy to reshape institutions and political practice, and how all of that was really tying in with the politics of the day.
Yeah, absolutely. So, I mean, it's a kind of development of the sort of stuff that I was talking about earlier about the 16th century, and just goes kind of a little wild in the 17th. In essence, you still have all these people in the 17th century who want jobs in government, which are, after all, good jobs. They provide steady income, mostly from the fees rather than the salary, and that's a kind of key point. So all these guys want these jobs. They want basically clerkships, which they're given a small fee by everyone who needs something from them. And many of their ideas are, I will get control over this body of paper. I will charge people fees to access it who need it, or to enter stuff into it, or whatever it is. That's one of the main things that they do. And so there's two versions of this answer. First, I'll go through the kind of practical one, and then the theoretical one. And so what you see in this is that there are all kinds of like people basically look who have some familiarity with the processes of, say, the chancery, see that there are producing clerical activities that are being done by individuals who have other responsibilities, and say, well, that should be a different job, and I should have it. And they then oft will often just start doing it, and then asking for a patent later. Well, one of the examples of this is that these cases of the Masters of Chancery see, which are just these fairly minor cases, typically about small fees that are owed from people from one person to another. And they don't even have registers initially, and then they start having registers. Again, it's just kind of this general part practice of how you govern and what you do as a member of the Elizabethan state in the early 17th century. Well, you have these things which nobody, as far as I can tell, would ever have need to consult of on later, but they start recording them. So then somebody else comes along and says, well, what we can't you can't you need to be able to navigate these things. So we should make a register of them so you can actually have a list of them. I'll keep the register and for the low price of, £10 a year, right? And they do it for a year, and then they get their position of £10 a year. And then somebody else comes along and says, well, the thing about these registers is that they're not in alphabetical order, they're in chronological order. We really need to figure out a better way to be able to search them. I'll make an index of them for the low price of £10 a year. And that's how all of these sort of, so on the one hand, that's sort of the practical way that all of these highly compartmentalized offices, which is what we associate with bureaucracy in a way, come into existence. It doesn't have to do with somebody standing over, like surveying the entirety of British of the English crown governance and saying, well, these are all its functions, and we should distribute them in such a fashion as to rationalize and operate to rationalize the operation. It has to do with all of these people, like, sort of, I mean, coming up with projects. That's the sort of the term of art for the early modern period. I mean, you could also say that they're grifters to a certain extent, coming along and just kind of like, charging money for stuff that, and the people who lose these fees are often, furious. But there's not necessarily a whole lot that they can do, especially if they are overwhelmed with other work, because everyone is kind of overwhelmed with overworked and drowning in stuff. And, so that's one way that that happens. The other thing that happens is that, individuals who are sitting on these mountains of paper often have, for example, like a whole bunch of stuff. Records, letters, or just records of various kinds of documents, articulating how the Privy Council has worked in the past, or actually the Exchequer is a better example. Just accounts of what the Exchequer has done, and one of the things that they often do is, again, if they're looking for preferment or patronage or advancement, is take all of these kinds of records and write. Treatises, compile them into treatises, prescribing what they see as the proper sort of the normative or prescriptive way that one should operate in the exchequer on the basis of past precedent. So they'll write these manuals of exchequer behavior, drawing from records drawn from all over the period of time, right? In order to and fashioning from it the kind of image of the exchequer they want, because again, because they have so much stuff at their disposal, they very frequently can find the thing that they want. That's one of the key things, is that when you have this ocean of information, it's a lot easier. I mean, you're not bound by consistency necessarily. You can find countervailing examples and go with the one that you want frequently. And this becomes a kind of a genre that is very common in the early seven. I mean, starting in the late 16th century and into the early 17th century. So, what you do if you're a minor exchequer official and you're looking for advancement is that you present to the Lord Treasurer a treatise on the treasury, which shows how it should work. What often there will be implicitly a job in there that you describe that has not, been is not being done or should be created that will enri help enrich you. And one of the other things it almost always does is extend the scope of powers of the exchequer to its like widest possible capacity, right? I mean, these are instruments for and emboldening and authorizing the offices that they do to operate like at the maximal possible level. But they also are, though, at least they're proposed to be, as kind of constitutions for the offices, rules, precedents, re regulations, duties. And again, these are just not things that existed before. If you're an exchequer official in the 13th century, you learn about exchequer behavior. I mean, they're actually that's a terrible example because for that alone there is one. But if you're a chancery official in the 13th century, you mostly learn how to do this just by observation. If there are texts that are written about it, no, people aren't reading them. And instead, in the early 17th century, you have all of these different descriptions of how certain offices and institutions are supposed to operate, and they're competing with each other, in part competing, but they're being produced by people who basically want advancement out of them. One of the key places institutions that are subject to this as well is Parliament, and that's where, there's been lots and lots of study amongst early modern British historians about the scope of parliamentary powers in the early 17th centuries, because the question, led to a civil war not long, several civil wars not long after. But it's also of a piece with discussions about, I mean, that genre of text also is being devised and directed towards, the court of requests and these other kinds of institutions, which don't seem to have that scope of power.
Yeah, all these like tiny ways for people to take bits of power for themselves wherever they see it. And then in chapter five, you start off by listing and then describing a series of strategies for information warfare. I would love if you could talk a little bit about those, but also something that I thought was really interesting to reflect on is what insights these tactics give us into the history of archives and the way we should approach archives today when we research the past. I guess what all that historical context means for historians who are approaching this archive.
Oh boy. Okay. So chapter five is kind of where, I mean, chapter four is a little bit where the worm turns, and all of a sudden, all of these things were, I mean, for all you listeners, for everyone out there who wants a reason to read the book that but doesn't care about history, this is a narrative of kind of like technological enthusiasm and conviction that this thing will work. I mean, running amok and then all of a sudden foundering and turning kind of dystopic. And this in chapter four is where it turns out that everyone sees the world a different way and has that these things can turn into competition. And in chapter five, I sort of talk about how these tools get used not just for personal advancement, but to actually like as destructive to others within the same society. There are a bunch of them. I mean, so there's disinformation that is there is basically providing something under the guise of information that is misleading or false or undermining of somebody else's position. I drew for the chapter is entitled Information Warfare, and I drew the terminology and also the kind of categories of information warfare from modern military manuals, which is actually evidently where it comes from. And it basically involves either preserving secrecy for your information, penetrating the desired secrecy of your enemies, or convincing or leaking through their lines information that you want them to have that they do not want to have, right? Disinformation is one of these where Basically, you circulate something, and it's to advance to one's political ends at to the detriment of one's adversaries. And that is something that happens all the time in early modern Europe in general. I think it may happen all the time everywhere, but it takes a particular form in early modern Europe because people use paper and publication and manuscripts as the primary means for doing this, of operating at this kind of distance in order to try to compel populations to think things that you want them to think. So there's that's one. Destruction is another, actually. And one of the odd things about destruction is that destruction is the most effective often. But one of the odd things about early modern Europe is that it seems like people destroy their own information so that the enemies can't get it, rather than destroy their enemies more frequently, which I think is striking. From trying to go through one by one. Oh, there's spycraft. Actually, I should say I love this chapter. Like, to me, this was the hardest chapter to write, but it has the craziest stories in it. There's spycraft where, again, individuals who are responsible for all three of these elements, that is leaking information selectively, preserving information, and penetrating the adversary's information lines, as it were. There's surveillance, which is, the obtaining from somebody else how to do so. So there are a couple of things I learned from this that I think are really interesting, and there are a few others. There's publication is one, or propaganda is one that I think was important, and sort of appropriation of other people's stuff. A couple of things that I learned from, like, I think that your question was alluding to, that sort of would draw out, which is that when you see these processes at work, all of a sudden a lot of the information or the material that you get that you're that the sources the historians work from, if you place it in the th through a three-dimensional situation that it came from, and if it is in one of these situations, like sort of one of these very fraught contexts where individuals are thinking very clearly about the information they produce and how it's going to benefit or disadvantage them in a context of war, really combat, life or death, is that the it exposes the motives and incentives to either say or not say things, to such a degree that it's hard to actually take much of it as just kind of neutral testimony, right? And that's one of the big issues. So, for example, I think the best example of this that I have in there, maybe, I hope, it was supposed to be, is a spy, a guy by the name of William Riley, who was a deputy clerk in the Tower of London. He's clearly a royalist for much of for much of his career, or for the early part of his career. He's a herald, and heralds tend to be aligned very closely with the king, in the Civil War. But he's also the person who best knows how to manage the records in the Tower of London. And so, even when the king leaves, and sort of, is exiled in Oxford in the 1640s, Parliament invites him back because they need help managing the records in the Tower of London in order to ensure stability and various other kinds of things that they're trying to show that they can do. And he comes back and is accused of being a spy right away. And he spends the next almost really 20, I mean, the almost really 20 years, I mean, the entire interregnum, claiming to not be a spy while maybe being a spy and maybe not being. I mean, you don't know. You just don't know what he is, and it's just impossible to say, because on the one hand, there's all these accusations, and you can take them seriously, and they kind of hold up, sort of. And on the other hand, it could be his cover, or it could be any number of things. And later, that's his son's position, is that my father was a spy. When the king comes, when the monarchy is restored, he says, "My father was a spy, of course. They just couldn't actually find this evidence on him." Now, at the time, Riley's saying, "I'm not a spy, I'm not a spy, I'm not a spy." And I try in the chapter to trace why it is, or how it is, that you just don't know. And that means any of the kind of like simple utterances that he makes could be completely true or completely false or somewhere in between. And from my perspective, this is not something that's just unique to spies. It's actually a kind of exemplary instance crystallizing all of the problems of historical testimony that historians have to work with. In this particular case, it really is a kind of like apotheosis, like the strongest possible version of it, because you could easily have been, killed on account of his spycraft or any number of other things. But what you're dealing with is recognizing that there are all these kinds of that one, people have all kinds of incentives and motives to write what they do, and it's not necessarily simply recording the truth for posterity. In fact, it's very rarely that. That's not why people write things down mostly. And it always actually like cracks me up when I read a history book where that sort of suggested that's what somebody's doing. I mean, people do that occasionally, but I really don't think that that's a normal mode. And the second thing is, part of the reason that we don't know, and part of the is that there are virtually all of these array or techniques of engaging in information warfare have an impact on the archival legacy that emerges from any particular moment. So you burn your paper, some important figure decides that they're going to be incriminated by their papers and burns all of them. Well, those are gone, right? And hopefully you have records that somebody else has created records that can illuminate that individual's activities sufficiently, but they might not be able to. You have record, there are archives. There's another really, I won't go too far into it, but like an example that I love where all of these Scottish records were basically, well, first were appropriated by Cromwell and when he went on his campaigns up there, brought back to England. And then at the Restoration, the Charles II said, sure, we'll give them back to you, and then decided that he didn't want to. So then they basically created a dubious paper trail, which suggested that the records were not there, that they didn't that was not part of the records that they had taken. Then they claimed that they were sending them back, but the ship sunk. And so the Scottish just sort of said, oh, they tried to send them back, but the ship sunk that contained them. They're all gone. In point of fact, they were just sitting in the state paper office for basically the next 170 years. Again, this is a case where there's a kind of misinterpreted, like the process by which the records survive is so complex and convoluted and so subject to a combination of effort and human control that is often not transparent at all and often never stated, but also chance. And it's just the processes by which things have come down to the present often is as illuminating about history as the document itself. And I think that without knowing that and without thinking about what is created in the first place, how it is created, and then also what it survives, there are essential stories and things that we can know about the past that are and also cautions about knowing the past that are overlooked.
Absolutely. Yeah. And then, I mean, I feel like we've already been touching on this, but in your epilogue, you talk about some of the larger impacts and questions and how the conversations you've started, you hope will not only impact conversations about the information state in early modern Britain, but also today. And, I think we really see these parallels for today. I feel this whole time like we could be talking about today or centuries ago. So what are some really important takeaways that you hope we can use for navigating not just that moment in early modern Britain, but also for navigating where we are today?
Well, that's a terrifying question. I mean, I'm glad you asked it, but it is a terrifying question. I mean, I'm gonna do the obnoxious historian thing and be like, well, the origins of this, but not exactly. But I will say that one of the sort of the things that really allowed me to write this book and to bring it together when I mean when at a certain point it really was like a study of lists of papers in an archive, and I was just like, I don't know how to animate this. I don't know, like thing about media revolutions was an important one. Experiencing a media revolution, which I think we are doing, it was also very helpful. And actually, this book took me longer to write than I ever imagined it would, and that was soul sucking in many ways. But it also allowed me a certain kind of perspective that I think was important. As I said, it started with a kind of like, don't get, Big Brother is watching you, and so be careful. Then to like, well, technocracy has its merits. And then 2016 was, I think, an incredibly important thing as we watched systems of communication just get rewired in a way that was chaotic, undesigned, and often contrary to the ostensible ideals of the people who were theoretically in control. And so going through all that and having to think through all of those things led me to a couple of things that I would say about the present. I will also say though that the epilogue was really difficult to write because I think that these things questions that issues that would be benef helpfully illuminated by the kinds of stuff I deal with in this book are just hitting us so fast. And one of, and they change so quickly. So when I was just in the course of writing the epilogue, which, I had versions of it that were about Twitter, versions of it that were about the Mar-a-Lago documents, versions of it that were about, Facebook and the, I mean, there, all of these things have elements of this, right? Of who gets to control information, what we do with it, how it's circulated, what kind of regulation is appropriate, what can we can expect on it, about it. There's just there's there, I mean, there are many other, there are actually many other ones as well, but like there are all these kinds of questions that are emerging. The one that, right, and actually like the one right now in some ways is like, is the kind of like order of the day is, Cory Doctorow's notion of unshittification is like how, who gets to control information and how they use it, and what's the social impact of that, and what happens when you give basically monopolies to information, to the information, to largely unregulated information powers. So I mean, I think the and the result of that is that I'm really glad that you liked the epilogue, because the hardest thing about that was to write something meaningful, in part because not only do all these issues changing, but like, academic books operate at a pace that is not like the news cycle these days, and especially not the online sort of news cycle, or Twitter, the Twitter news cycle. And it's very easy to write something like, I've the reason I didn't have any of those versions in about specific individuals is that actually, it, I was writing this knowing it would come out 9 months from now, and it was quite possible that at that point Elon Musk's sort of like purchase on the historic, the imagination of the contemporary imagination, it's going to disappear. I mean, it will happen sometime. It will happen before, when people are not predicting that it will happen. Those kinds of things happen. It's very easy to write an extremely out of date academic book if you're trying to talk about the present, because the books, it just, the production process takes 9 months, from the time you submit the actual final text. So sorry, that's like that, I mean, I think that is actually a relevant thing, because thinking about these temporalities of what you're writing and how you're writing is not an insignificant thing. So as a long way of saying, I'm glad you like the epilogue, because I had to write it in a more anodyne fashion than I wanted to, because I had no idea what the future held. But I do think that there are a couple of things about that I would say about it. One is that the enormous amount of power that is wielded by individuals who control information, or who have access to or control the storage sites for information, but also means of communication, and the degree to which there needs to be some systems of accountability in order to ensure that they are not simply operating in their own best interest. I actually see, in the end, I see the guy, the most of the people I was looking at as being sort of as double-edged swords. I actually think, that they do things like create the modern sort of notion of public accountability in a weird way. I don't really talk about this in the book, but they have a notion of the public, which is usually wielded in their cases strictly for their own benefit. But it is one that gets kind of like equally shared and appropriated by lots and lots of people, to the point where it is good that we have public offices. I do fundamentally think that. And it's just a kind of an irony or something to keep to bear in mind and learn from, that this was created in large part, or that their powers were maximized because there were certain individuals who want better jobs. That is what happened, but it's a historical irony more than anything else. What it also shows, though, is that the technologies themselves are not determinative of the future. There's a kind of anti-technological determinist element at the end. And that isn't very much about historical debates, but it's also very much about the present. I think an enormous part of the problem that we have as a society have visited upon ourselves is by simply buying into the axiom that information wants to be free. Information has no wants. Like, it is, that is not a thing, right? The social and cultural and political and epistemological tools and techniques that we bring to information are what determines its meaning. Full stop. Right. The technologies create possibilities. What possibilities are chosen amongst those comes from all of those other factors. And I think that that's really important, because there is a way in which, I mean, I hadn't even mentioned it, but AI, like, again, this is, it is absolutely ludicrous what is happening with this. And it's all the logical basis for it is that information, like the technologies, are just a, evolve as they do, and there's nothing that we can do about that. And it's madness. I mean, there's just rampant violation of copyright law and all. I mean, to me, it just looks like an Again, I would not have printed this. This would not have been in my epilogue, even though it's the thing that like it would be most timely right now. But it is a very good case of, we're just going to let the technology do what it does, as being an attitude that is wrong, because actually there are individuals and corporations who are specifically promoting and pushing this particular line and benefiting from it immeasurably. And so one of the things that I think is important to learn from this is that, we should not let those people do whatever they feel like without any regulation or pushback, or buying the kind of line that AI is inevitable and that it has to work the way that it does. So that is an important one. And in part, it's also that like a lot of the people who are going to grab it, like this is, but the other part of this is that, in fact, I think that this is, I'm no fan of grifters doing that kind of thing. But I also do think that this is just kind of what happens when you have the chaos and tumult of a media revolution of this sort. There is a certain kind of inevitability that, or not inevitability, well, because that does sound a little bit like technological determinism, but I think there's a kind of social dynamic that necessary that often arises, or that arose in early modern Europe around the circulation of paper, and is arising today around the circulation of all these digital technologies, where individuals try to find various carve-outs for to enrich themselves from it, and in doing so, they often are not focused primarily on sort of social or ethical values more broadly, or the health of the society, so much as things that they think will enrich themselves or further their careers or what have you. And the dynamics of that, often, especially if the goal is to capture more audiences, can be quite deleterious as well, because sort of the. And so, for example, one of the dynamics that I see in the 1640s, the period of real social breakdown and civil war in England, is that, if you have a flooded print market, people want to buy the things that is kind of most outrage or most sort of like heat inducing, right? Same dynamic that was Facebook in 2016, right? Like, write the most outrageous thing, and you'll get the most clicks. You get the most clicks, you get the most support. I mean, it wasn't advertiser money for in the 1640s, but like it was more, sales basically, name recognition and a number of other things. That's created by democratization of media. And I do think the democratization of media is fundamentally probably a good thing, but it does have these negative consequences, which I think that need to be faced up to as a society, in terms of that it allows destructive voices to proliferate and to connect with each other. And that's and how we actually and the idea that that is unmanageable or is to me wrong, and it's something that we need to face up to. How to do so is somebody else's problem, responsibility. I have some suggestions, I think, sort of in the book, but those are the kinds of dynamics that I see broadly construed both in early modern Britain and actually Europe as a whole and in the present. And I mean, I think it's not a particularly optimistic book, because I don't know that we have the resources at present to do that. And I'm not even sure that you can look at early modern Britain and find them. Because what happened in early modern Britain in a weird way was that the state consolidated a lot of authority. And because of the various sort of constitutional structures, and in fact, the Glorious Revolution, where there was a kind of revolt against an individual wielding authority over those structures that seemed anathema to the lives and preferences of many individuals, that was some a lot of that authority was diffused. I don't know that we have, or sort of dispersed or decent, not as, decentralized is slightly wrong, but the state became something that sort of was balanced against itself. The at present, I think that what we have is multinational, corporations, information corporations like Google, Meta, I guess we're supposed to call it, really, really sort of operating at a level of scale in terms of information and impunity that is dangerous to me. So, and they don't have those kinds of responsibilities or subjects in the way that, the Crown did. So.
Definitely. Yeah. I mean, lots to keep thinking about.
Sorry, that was a little bit long.
No, I mean, my brain is spinning with so many more things to think about and conversations to have with different people. So thank you. But before we wrap up today, I would love to hear, no pressure, what you're working on next. I don't know if you have any new projects that have come out of this book or totally new things that you're turning to now that this is wrapped up.
So I have a couple of ideas. One thing that I've been doing for the last couple of years now, William and Mary is the site of the Alejandro Institute of Early American History and Culture, and I've had a variety of roles there. I'm the editor of their book series right now, which is the premier series in early American history. It's great series. We do great books. It's a very different kind of job, and I've learned a lot in my various roles there for over the last almost decade now. So I've been doing a lot of Atlantic stuff. And this is actually one of the things, I didn't even mention this. I wonder if you thought this was the direction the epilogue was going to go, which is that the British Empire and all of its faults, I would say, are basically constructed on infrastructure that is like this, where there is a small network of individuals who are allowed to contribute information. And in some ways, like, that's the great fear, because the British Empire is, you know, incredibly extractive and destructive and violent and exploitative entity. I was trained as a Europeanist and a British historian by Tony Grathen and Peter Lake, but I've been doing a lot of Atlantic stuff. So to me, I've been thinking about projects about how to study the British Empire as a whole through these lenses. So that's one possibility. That might be a little bit beyond my scope. And, you know, I've now taken a long time to write two books. I would really like to write like a short little punchy book. That might be lots of fun. So one of the characters in this book, Thomas Wilson, who's sort of the wildest person in it. He is the person who really consolidates the state paper office for the first time into a powerful into an institution that works. But he has all these other really weird elements. Like, for example, he's the guy who he's the only guy in London or in England who receives any letters directly from East India Company factories in Japan, and he reports them to King James, who's like, "Well, you're just lying." He just finds himself, he's kind of like a Walter Mitty character. He just finds himself in all of these odd situations over the course of his life. And I think he could tell a story of global, sort of information circuits on his, in like, and sort of global and the local in England through his correspondence and his work. So that would be a short one that I would consider doing. But the thing that I actually, most would like to do and won't do next, because it will take forever, actually, there's two things. One is a study of the heraldic practices, because I think that, you know, my first book was about denaturing how we understand the history by thinking about how the practices of making history work. Book has been about doing that for politics. I think it'd be interesting to do that in terms of kind of like social status and family lines, which is the system of that. So to really see how early modern heralds created those things. But the thing that I should say for this audience, sorry, it sounds like I have a lot of ideas. It's what it is that I have many ideas that I won't follow up. But the thing that I should say for this audience is that that I think I might be most likely to do, because it's both relatively short and clear, is a study of Marianne Everett Green, who was a 19th century archivist who's actually really responsible for there's an enormous amount of British history. What she did was she made the calendar of state papers, which before you could go off to the National Archives relatively easily and call up the original documents of it, were just sort of summaries of the papers in the National Archives that historians used for a century. She is, you know, it's a fascinating case. I mean, a woman in the 19th century just doing all of this incredibly important work that really did train the eye, as it were, of what British historians studied. There are a couple of studies of her, sort of article length, which are interesting. They don't really bring the same toolkit to it that I would use, which is practice, you know, the sort of toolkit of thinking about practice, thinking about media, thinking about materials, sort of material history, and seeing how what I'm interested in is basically seeing how she can created the degree to which she helped create what sort of the modern practice of history, but also the modern conception of early modern British history, and also what that therefore leaves out to a certain, you know, that's. I don't know exactly what shape this would take, but to me, it's a really interesting question, you know, and picks up on lots of the themes and issues of this about information circulating in three dimensions over time, you know, what gets lost, what gets magnified, what gets distorted. Just sort of seeing her as being instrumental to that process, because it really is true that she, in some ways, she created the archive that people actually used, not the archive over the course of her career. That's been pretty appealing to me for various reasons. So we'll see.
Well, that sounds fantastic. Thank you so much for chatting today. Once again, I've been speaking with Nick Popper, author of The Spectre of the Archive, Political Practice and the Information State in Early Modern Britain, published by University of Chicago Press in 2024. My name is Jen Hoyer, and you're listening to New Books Network.